91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program looks at the legal aspects of social media. In the words of our guest, attorney Ethan Wall, it's the wild, wild west out there until new laws are created. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Ethan Wall is an authority on social media and the law. His blog addresses such questions as Twitter and Facebook in regard to employers and employees. He's an adjunct professor at Nova Southeastern University and a frequent blogger. Can an employer require a job applicant to give access to a Facebook account? Social media privacy is another big concern. And of course, we'll be taking your calls. First, NPR and regional news. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we're devoted to the area of social media and the many legal questions which easily arise.
The use of internet-based communications have burgeoned over the past few years. 400 million Americans use Facebook, 20 million use Twitter, yet clear legal precedents are limited.
But we have answers for you today. With us is attorney Ethan Wall, who's an adjunct professor of law at Nova Southeastern University and the president of the Social Media Law and Order, LLC.
He's written two books on the subject, including topics about social media and the workplace and social media marketing for law firms.
And he's here in the studio for a return visit.
Welcome back.
So good
Ethan
to be
Wall.
Good to see you, Ethan.
Good to have you. So I think what strikes me the most about all this, and we said it in the introduction, there's so little precedent and so few laws enacted and so few lawyers specializing in social media legal issues, leaving a lot of room for questions and doubts and interpretations and misinterpretations. So just if you would address that.
Absolutely. You know, social media seems to be a wild, wild west where we don't know what rules govern our online activities. But it's not really the case, meaning just because social media is a new medium doesn't mean that it's an unregulated medium. So when we talk about what rules govern, we have to find out what existing laws might apply to social media and what new laws might be developing all the time to govern our online conduct.
But do the laws keep up with the technology? I mean, we're creating more... There's more social media being created than I would think the laws can keep up with.
Absolutely. Technology advances so much faster than the law can adapt, and we see this. There might be fundamental change in the world that we need our legislators to act on, and it's a slow-moving
process.
But by the time that I just finished that sentence, probably dozens of new technologies and applications and social media sites may have been developed, and so it's so tricky to play catch-up and see how we can take these old laws and apply them to new technologies until something new and better is created.
Well, today's news hits home. Miss Puerto Rico suspended for making Muslim slurs on Twitter. Of course, she probably sent signed releases and things, but possibly she could sue for violation of her freedom of speech rights.
It's true. I mean, the first case that ever came out of Twitter was a defamation case. There was an artist named Courtney Love, who was made famous by being the wife to the late Kurt Cobain and the lead singer of the band Hole. And she said some really terrible things about her designer on Twitter and was sued based upon one single tweet, saying that you have now said something false and defamatory about somebody else, and it creates some legal liability. So the question of freedom of speech, what we can say and what we can't,
versus
our right to govern, and by contract law, what people may be able to say and not say, because we don't want Miss Universe or Miss Puerto Rico coming out there and saying defamatory things online.
But it's so hard. Where did my mind just go? I'm thinking, on the one hand, yes, freedom of speech. On the other, there is slander, libel, defamation of character, all those things that are suable.
Exactly. So the freedom of speech is more limited than we think. I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch Nickelodeon.
You're still a kid, Ethan. I hate to tell you.
It's true.
Okay,
it's
go
true.
Ahead. Go ahead.
But remember this show called Kids Court, where people's parents would be on the stand and all the children in the audience would yell, "You can't do that to us kids." And I remember when I was younger, citing the freedom of speech when I was yelling at my parents. And I remember my father looking at me and he said, "Ethan, I hope that you know that the freedom of speech only extends to the government, not to your father."
Who pays the bills.
Exactly. So, you know, the freedom of speech comes from our First Amendment. And the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the freedom of speech, meaning our limited freedom of speech rights only extends to the government stopping us from saying things, not necessarily private companies or somebody on Twitter who might say something wrong that they can get in serious trouble for.
So do the libel laws subject to newspapers and magazines apply to our Facebook posts?
Absolutely. So libel and slander are actionable legal claims.
Slander being vocal.
Correct. And libel being written.
Okay.
So or broadcast.
Or broadcast. Some kind of fixed tangible medium, which now extends to a tweet, an Instagram post, or maybe even a Snapchat.
But I thought those disappeared right after you do them when you play them the first time. You're looking at me like, "Bonnie, nothing disappears. Once you've done it, it's there."
Bonnie, what happens on Snapchat stays on Snapchat.
It does?
Or it's not maybe necessarily on Snapchat, but what people think is that it's gone forever. Like,
right.
Inspector Gadget. Remember he used to get a note from the chief and it said, "This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds," and he crumples it up and throws it into the trash bin. And of course, the chief is there and it explodes. Not so much on Snapchat, meaning that data still exists somewhere, and usually it's inside the computer or the cell phone or iPhone or device where it was made. And so if I could get my hands on your phone, Bonnie, and you were sending Snapchats, I can have a computer forensic person who's a lot more technical than I am go in there and find pieces of that data. And so it really does exist, and it comes up in court cases all the time.
Well, let's talk about this sticky wicket. There are legal risks using social media in the hiring process, and there are legal risks not using social media in the hiring process. Tell us about that. I mean, this is really confusing now because you say that, or it's written, that if an employer doesn't access somebody's Facebook account, for example, and there was stuff on there that would have made him a bad employee for whatever reason, then they were negligent. And they can be held accountable for negligent hiring?
Yes.
Okay, all right, explain.
So let's lay the landscape. Well, first of all, it's clear everyone's on social media, even my mom. And I know this because this morning you tagged me on the Topical Currents Facebook page, and I get a frantic Facebook message from my mom saying, "Why didn't you tell me that you're going to be here?"
So I got Paul in trouble. Paul Leary does our Facebook, so he tagged you. Okay.
Thanks, Paul. But of course, our employees and our applicants are online. And as businesses, we have the need to search and figure out what our employees or applicants are saying and doing on social media so we don't hire somebody in our company that can get us in trouble. And it's not just practical. As you said, Bobby, we have a legal responsibility called negligent hiring to search our applicants online, meaning if we knew or should have known that someone that we are going to hire had the propensity to harm somebody and we didn't do our research, we as the employer can be held responsible. The classic example is this. We have our WLRN studios and we need to protect it at night from people who might be breaking in. So we want to hire a security guard, but if we didn't do our background check and learned that this security guard has 3 or 4 arrests for assault and battery, and someone walks down the street at night and they beat this person up, the security guard uses excessive force, WLRN might be held responsible for being negligent and not searching this applicant before hiring them. And the same rules now apply to social media, meaning it's so easy to conduct a Facebook search over someone. If we don't take that step, we might be held responsible if there were posts on there where someone might be saying derogatory things about women and they come on the air and say something poorly about Muslims or women.
Okay, but what about all the protected information that's on Facebook? Your sexual preference, your nationality, your age, all those things that they're not supposed to use against you, but that they can use to discriminate against you when they are considering hiring you.
And there's the rub, meaning there is laws, federal laws that are anti-discrimination laws, meaning you can't discriminate against someone based upon their age or gender or religion or nationality or disability or sexual preference or whether they're married or they're not.
Right.
So when I would, if I were to come here to interview for a position, you wouldn't ask me those questions. But the moment that you access my Facebook page or my LinkedIn account, you expose yourself to all of the protected information that you cannot consider in the hiring process. And there are real, actual legal cases where someone has been sued for viewing someone's LinkedIn profile. One of the most recent cases was called the University of Kentucky versus Glasgow. Glasgow was a professor at the University of Kentucky, and he was up for tenure. The university reviewed his LinkedIn profile and saw that there were discussions about what was happening in the Middle East. And there were comments made about the interaction between Muslims and what was happening in the Middle East just from a purely cultural standpoint. Well, he didn't get the tenured position, and he sued the University of Kentucky, saying, "You viewed my LinkedIn profile, you exposed yourself to information about my religion, and that's why you didn't hire me." And when the university moved to dismiss that lawsuit, the court denied their motion to dismiss and said there's evidence that you accessed someone's profile, that you saw that there was information about their religion, and you made an adverse hiring decision based upon that. Or
but afterwards. How can you prove that? I mean, you're saying you have to do due diligence in checking them out, but then if they get that information, how do we know? How can you prove they're using it against someone?
So that's the challenge employers face, is how do you, on the one hand, do your, as you say, due diligence, while at the same time not exposing yourself to the protected information you can't consider? And here's how companies can do it. First, they have to separate the person doing the searching from the one who's making the hiring decision. Meaning, let's say that you wanted to explore my social media profiles. Perhaps Bonnie does a search on my Facebook page and then supplies information to Joe and says, "Joe, here's pictures of Ethan out in the community doing wonderful things.
Here he is at a party with a lampshade on his head."
Exactly. And Joe's going to say, Ethan, lampshade, that's not what we want to have here. But what Joe didn't know was anything about my religion, sexual preference, age, national origin, because you provided him only that information. So companies need to have a policy of how it is searched and make sure that the Facebook stalker is separate and distinct.
So you have to document that, though, don't you? That Bonnie did this role and I did that role. And
yes. Not only must there be a social media employment discrimination policy that says how it's going to happen in the workplace and then train your employees to do so, but here's something extra, Joe. And that is, you have to search everyone equally. Meaning, I can't just search people who are black but not white. I can't search women but not men, because then I'm using discriminatory employment practices. So you don't have to search everyone, but you might have a policy that says we have an available position and we're going to collect resumes and then we're going to decide to search the top 5 candidates. But if you're going to search those 5 candidates, you have to make sure that they're all searched equally in a non-discriminatory format and then document this, because as Bonnie said, how are you going to prove this at trial?
That it swayed you.
Exactly.
Or that it didn't.
Correct. And if you don't have a policy and you don't have the right type of compliance procedures and documents to demonstrate to the court, then it's Bonnie's word against mine. And Bonnie, I've been in court for 8 years now. I've got a little bit of experience here in persuading a jury. So, you know, but if your attorney came to the court and said, "Here's our search policy. This is how we handle it in every situation. Here's the file that we have when we searched Ethan's social media accounts," which shows that Bonnie conducted the search, but Joe conducted the hiring process, that Bonnie only provided the following non-discriminatory information to Joe, and Joe based his decision on that solely. then, what am I going to argue against that evidence?
So you're saying you better have your policies in place here, employers.
Bingo. You want to be proactive, not reactive, because it's a lot less expensive to set up a responsible infrastructure, implement a policy, and do training than it is to pay a lot of high-priced lawyers to go into court and fight this out for years and years and years. And even if you win, you still have to pay those attorneys anyway. So an ounce of prevention is certainly worth a lot more than a pounding of legal fees.
Well, we're going to take a break on today's Topical Currents. We're visiting with attorney Ethan Wall. We're talking about law and social media. We'll be back with more.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, an author and attorney and social media legal expert, consultant, and adjunct professor of social media and the law at Nova Southeastern University, Ethan Wall. And he's also the founder of the social media law firm. They're dedicated to providing solutions to social media legal issues like we're discussing today. And by the way, if you have a question, maybe you're an employer or an employee with a question about social media law, maybe you want to know if you need to turn your username and password over to a potential employer, or any other question, 1-800-743-9576, our number 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org.
Ethan, what judgments have recently been rendered for social media court cases that people should be aware of?
In addition to the University of Kentucky versus Glasgow case, there was also a case involving Hertz Rent-A-Car.
Oh, that one's great. Oh. I read that.
Yes. Okay. So a lot of times I'll talk about issues such as negligent hiring and discrimination, and people will say, well, is this an actual case? Can I really be sued for it? And the answer is yes. So in the Hertz case, there was a Hertz employee who was being verbally abusive to people on the job.
Customers.
Exactly. So not only was the employee sued, but also Hertz. And the claim that was filed against Hertz was negligent hiring. And the court said, you didn't conduct your social media search on this employee, or you would have easily known, based upon their public Facebook page, that this person made abusive comments about people all of the time.
Or was a skinhead or something.
Exactly. And so these are real cases affecting real companies that we need to take solutions in a proactive measure before we find ourselves in the courtroom.
And what happened with the Hertz case?
Hertz case was ultimately settled out of court. And so we don't know what the answer is. And it's so difficult for me to
have to swallow
that. So
when they're settled out of court, then it doesn't set any precedents.
It's true. Well, it doesn't set a precedence as to whether or not Hertz in that case would have been liable for a claim of negligent hiring, but it sets a different precedent. That is that Hertz moved to dismiss the case, saying you can't file a claim against me based upon my failure to search your social media. And the court denied that motion to dismiss and set a legal precedent that says that plaintiffs do have a right to file an actionable claim against a company for negligent hiring if the employer doesn't conduct the right types of reasonable search procedures before you hire them. So what it does is it creates precedent to open the door to a new legal claim for social media negligent hiring that before the Hertz and University of Kentucky case was only theoretical, but now
it's actually. Losing that motion, that's why they settled then. Once it was established, they could be sued.
Right.
Correct. And then at that particular time, any business says, okay, how much is it going to cost me to go into court and fight this battle? I've got to pay my attorneys. I need to conduct depositions. And even if at the end of the day, I win that trial and I'm victorious and I high-five my attorney on the way out, I'm still getting an invoice for
all those hours.
All those hours. And here's what makes matters worse, Joe. So everyone has insurance these days, or we should, especially if we're running a business. But discrimination claims are generally carved out of someone's insurance policy. And so companies might find that they have to fund the litigation themselves, which then incentivizes them to settle a case at an early stage, knowing that their insurance policy might not cover it. And so a lot of the times the game in litigation is very skilled and knowledgeable plaintiff's attorneys now knowing that there's a new claim that they can file against a company. And they know, based upon this new precedent, that they have a good faith legal basis to file that complaint for negligent hiring, and know that because it's going to survive a motion to dismiss, so long as they have the right allegations and the right facts, they might find a lucrative settlement at the end of the day. And so the company needs to have that right type of infrastructure in the beginning, so that the moment they get this demand letter or get this complaint, they can go to that plaintiff's attorney and say, not us. We have this policy. We have the procedures documented against your plaintiff. If you go into court and proceed with this lawsuit, now knowing that there was no improper and inappropriate search, you, plaintiff's attorney, are going to be on the line for our attorney's fees and sanctions. And what is going to happen in this situation? I'm going to suggest that plaintiff's attorney is going to say, you know what? There are other fishes to fry. I'm going to go after someone who didn't have their ducks in a row. So having that proactive solution in the first place will help to prevent lawsuits in the first place and minimize the likelihood that a company has to pay a large legal settlement.
Where are we in Florida as far as negligent hiring and that business?
So negligent hiring has been a law in Florida probably about 20 or 30 years before I was born. And so now that there are the first few social media negligent hiring cases that are coming up across the country, Florida is absolutely going to follow suit. And there has been a new law that has been working its way through the Florida legislature over the past few years governing the use of social media in the hiring process, specifically with an employer's ability to demand that an applicant turn over their social media usernames and passwords.
And where does that stand?
Well, currently, the Florida bill died in the legislature in 2014, meaning there was a Senate bill that was proposed that was called an Act Relating to Social Media Privacy. And the law was designed to make it illegal for employers to require that an applicant hand over their username and password as a condition to being considered for their employment. And the reason that this law was offered is because it now exists in 23 other states across the country. One state started it, I believe it was in New Hampshire, and states begin to follow suit. The Florida bill, however, didn't get passed. And the reason why it didn't get passed is because there was an exception that was carved out in the law that would have allowed employers to demand a username and password for, quote, business reasons, close quote. And there was no definition as to what
business reasons mean. What does that mean?
I don't know. I can make that stuff up on the drop of a hat. And so the law really had no teeth because of this exception. And so the bill is probably going to be revised in a way that would avoid that particular exception. And I would suspect that we see a new bill back in front of the Florida legislature early in 2016, especially with so many states passing similar laws.
They probably based that on anti-competitive reasons or something like that, where they want to find out if you're going to work for company X and you used to work for company B, that you haven't been on there soliciting clients while you were employed by company B.
Of course. And that's really the struggle in the legislature these days, is we have both a conservative and a liberal view. Meaning a conservative view in the legislature wants to protect businesses. We want to enact laws that make them more business friendly. And therefore, with a more conservative legislature, they're less likely to enact a law that's going to give employees more rights. Where a liberal leaning legislature, meaning having more senators or member of the state house that might be part of a Democratic Party, in those states you're seeing more employee friendly laws that would give them those types of rights.
All right, we're speaking with Ethan Wall, an author, an attorney, and social media legal expert. He has a law firm now, the Social Media Law Firm, and we have calls.
Why don't we give out the number again?
1-800-743-9576, 743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, 32 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with attorney Ethan Wall. He's an adjunct professor of law at Nova Southeastern University. He's also the founder and president of Social Media Law and Order, LLC. He's also an author. He has two books on the subject. And we'll take those calls. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. Also, you can get in with Bonnie at email. That's radio@wlrn.org. Kyle in Plantation. Hey there.
Hi. Excuse me. Hi. Thank you for your discussion. First of all, why anybody would remain on Facebook is beyond me. I really don't care what time you brushed your teeth this morning. But aside from that, when you put something on the social media, it's out there. I mean, so why would not somebody use it? I don't get it. I happen to be a retired lawyer, and the last time I accessed my Facebook account was over a year ago, because I'm just not interested. But as an employer, hey, you got to use what you use. Am I wrong?
No, Kyle, you're right, meaning employers need to do a social media search, and they must, based upon the law of negligent hiring. The question is how to do it in a way that complies with the law. Now, Kyle brings up a really interesting point, and that is the difference in almost generational views of privacy and sharing. Kyle is a retired lawyer, and he's smart. He knows that there is a virtual treasure chest of discoverable information that's online. So why, oh, why would somebody take a picture of what they're eating for lunch today?
Or the lampshade on the head. When
Exactly.
Now, as lawyers these days, we need to understand that there is social media evidence that's out there and how we can go about collecting it properly in both a manner that complies with our Florida bar ethics rules, meaning I can't create a fake profile and send someone a friend request in a manner that might be deceptive in order to get access to information. But Kyle's so right, meaning employers need to understand that what their applicants and employees say and do on social media can get them in trouble. So the question is, how do they go about doing the search in a manner that is lawful?
I can say I'm a multimillionaire. Doesn't mean it's true. People lie on you know, social media all the time. Look at the dating sites.
Yeah.
I'm handsome. I'm, you know, strong. I'm a millionaire.
Kyle, people lie all the time, not on social media. I mean, it's just something that...
It felt like Kyle was reading my online dating profile. If I had one, I'm strong and I have Photoshopped more muscles into my shirt. But you know what? It's true, and we do see this all the time in our personal lives, meaning I may know someone out there who, you know, is such a grumpy person. They're always of a rain cloud over their head, but on social media, they have the nicest selfies with rainbows.
Angelic.
And hashtag gratitude, hashtag loving life, and I'm like, hashtag you're miserable. Like, come on, what's real and what's not? But during the break, Joe and I were talking about the issue of what happens in the securities law context when somebody might be using social media to help overvalue or devalue someone else's company. And there is a real case that happened recently involving the Securities Exchange Commission, who filed criminal charges against an owner of a company who was inflating the stock price by posting inaccurate information about their company on Twitter.
Knowingly inaccurate information.
Our quarterly report is outstanding.
No, exactly. So Kyle's right. People do lie online, and That's okay, because as Bonnie said, people lie in person all the time. The question is, how do those lies affect us in a legal way? How could they get not only the liar in trouble, but let's say this liar is an employee of a company who now is lying about how great their product is or what it could do. Can the company be liable for an employee's inaccurate review or post? Or let's say the employee posts a comment on a product on Amazon that says, "This is the best product in the world. It has helped make me stronger and bigger and more handsome." Right. But the product doesn't do that, and the person didn't identify that they worked for the company themselves. That may violate federal advertising laws as well. So lying gets us in trouble, not just in the real life, and not just on dating sites, because if you put that information out there, Kyle, and you go on that date and they realize you're not and big and strong and handsome, then it's just not going to work.
So if somebody is an employee and says, "Oh, you know, this did this amazing things and for me," and it's not true, someone has to get the product, not get the same results, but then I'm sure somewhere in the small print, maybe it would say, you know, not guaranteed results or something. I mean, they do that all the time.
It's true, but there are almost two different laws at place. So the first law that you're talking about is, are there small fine print that might excuse a product from not doing exactly what it says for advertising? Of course, the government and the legislature don't want companies lying about their products, but then being able to put really, really, really small print.
Results may vary.
Exactly. Right. The difference here is whether or not it is misleading for an employee to post great things about a product but not tell someone that they work for the company. And here's why. Let's say that I wanted to get advice on a particular product or service, but I didn't really know. What am I going to do? I'm going to
look at the...
I'm going to search online.
Right.
And wouldn't it make me more likely to buy a product if I saw all of these positive reviews as opposed to negative? But would it change my purchasing decision if I knew that the people who were leaving these positive reviews were employees of the company themselves? Of course it would. I'd say, well, maybe this isn't as five-star as a product as it is. And so the law wants to prevent employees from putting misleading information online that might affect a consumer's decision. So what employers need to do is to say, look, employees, we know that you're going to be on social media and we want you to talk about the wonderful things that our product does. But if you are going to do that,
say,
here's the policy that you need to follow. Here are the checklists that you need to do, which might say, you know, I'm an employee of this company, but I still want to tell you about all of these great things that my product does. Or somehow identify themselves as someone from the company itself. And so having that policy and training will help employers to stay out of trouble, but also let their employees talk about the wonderful things their product does online.
Could we briefly turn to, say, medical privacy? Let's say I go on Facebook and mention that I had a slight heart attack or something, and I had treatment, and my friends were all commenting on that. And then a week later, I go and try and get a lot of insurance or something. Can that insurance company go there and find out that I have a pre-existing condition?
Sure. Insurance companies all the time are evaluating.
But what about HIPAA laws?
Okay, so
I guess because I put it out there.
Exactly. So let's say, what is a HIPAA law and then how does it apply in Joe's situation? So HIPAA is a federal law that protects patients' privacy rights. So what it prohibits is a doctor or medical professional or someone from the hospital posting something on social media in a way that would give up patient information. But if Joe's taking a selfie from the operating table and posting it online, HIPAA's not going to protect him. And I'm telling you, the insurance company will be searching your profiles.
Wow.
The question is, are they searching them in a way that could get the insurance company in trouble? Are they using deceiving tactics by maybe creating a fake profile of a sexy-looking nurse, you know, to add Joe as a friend on Facebook so that they can stalk
out
him? That's not okay. But if Joe just puts it out there publicly and he uses that Snapchat that you thought went away but didn't, of course, the insurance company can use that information.
Let's take a call. This is Jason in Miami. Hi.
Hi, Hi, actually, hey, Ethan, this is Jason Block, Judge Block. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. How are you?
I'm fine. First of all, compliments to you. As always, you are excellent. I've seen Ethan in panels and conducting courses, and he really is quite an authority, as always. Ethan, so I was just wondering, the listeners might be interested if you know, what is the latest on judges and social media? Are they allowed to have Facebook friends, LinkedIn connections, and do you see that evolving anywhere? Where do you think that's going?
Oh, great question. Ethan?
Yes, I think I need to begin by saying, may it please the court. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes. Judges can have a social media account. The question comes down to what they say on the account and what they do with it. So our members of the judiciary in Florida are governed by a particular set of rules called judicial canons. It says what we can and cannot do as judges on social media. And there's a recent Florida bar ethics opinion that says that judges can absolutely have a social media account to connect with family and friends, and even to have a section of their peers create a campaign page for purposes of an upcoming state judiciary election. However, judges are prohibited from doing the following. First, they shouldn't be friends on Facebook or a connection on LinkedIn with an attorney who is likely to appear before them in court. And the reason is it may create the appearance of impropriety if a judge is friends with one attorney, but
just
not
the word.
Other. Exactly.
Right.
Now, what's so interesting is that there was a recent appellate opinion that says, well, Facebook uses friends, but LinkedIn's just connections. Isn't that something different? And the ethics committee said no, meaning you still can't be a connection with an attorney who might appear before you in court, because there are cases where a criminal defendant filed an appeal and said it was unfair that I was convicted because the judge was friends with the prosecutor, and the appellate court reversed the conviction and required there to be a new trial in front of a new judge. And what the appellate opinion said, Joe, about friends, is that friends is such a colloquial phrase nowadays. What might be more appropriate for social media? A virtual stranger. Meaning, just like what Kyle talked about us earlier, we may not know who these people are, but we're friends online. Right. What does that mean? Everyone's friends nowadays. And in fact, in California, you can be friends with a judge on Facebook so long as the moment you have a trial in front of them, you remove that friendship. But currently the law in Florida is it would be inappropriate for a member of our judiciary to be friends on Facebook with someone who is likely to appear before
them. And the judge could be judged by his likes.
That's true. So let's explore that point for a moment, because there were some people who believed that judges shouldn't be able to have a campaign page, because if an attorney likes the judge on a campaign page, is it the same as being friends?
Right.
And the Florida Bar Ethics Committee said, no, it's different, and here's why. In order for there to be a social media friendship, the judge must accept that person as a friend or invite them. There must be an agreement to be someone's friend online, where a campaign page doesn't allow the judge to accept who becomes a fan and who doesn't. If you like the page, you like the page. You can't make somebody unlike it.
So they had no participation. It's just it's there and someone liked it. So because the judge had no part in accepting it, or
in a sense.
Exactly. There'd be no appearance because both attorneys on both sides have an equal ability to become a fan of that judge's campaign page, just as in the same way they can host a fundraiser for the judge at their law firm to help raise money to support a particular candidate.
But if a judge likes a racist statement or something,
That's
a problem.
Yes, and if they comment about what's happening in a current case in front of them, or an issue that might be relevant to a current case, there have been a few members of the judiciary that have been sanctioned by their particular state bars for posting things on social media relating to their cases. So oftentimes, I'll conduct judicial training seminars to say, here are the rules, here's where judges are getting in actual trouble, and here's where His Honor and others can stay out of trouble for staying and playing on Facebook.
Well, Judge, we have to take a break. You may step down.
Thanks for calling.
You bet.
We're speaking with Ethan Wall, author, attorney, social media legal expert, and the founder of the Social Media Law Firm. Last break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and author, attorney, and social media legal expert, Ethan Wall. Lots of calls we are going to get to. Before that, though, Ethan, this is really interesting, and you sent this to me, and I want to talk about it. It's about someone searches online to get a Twitter account, get someone to set up a Twitter account, and does their Twitter account and their logo, and you know, their website and their logo or their Twitter account, whatever it is, who owns it after it's done? The people who pay for it?
That's what we all think, but that's not really the case. So who owns someone who creates your website? We all think that, or most people think, if I pay someone a bunch of money to develop my website or my social media pages or my logo, that I own it because I paid for it.
Right.
But the law actually says something different. Copyright law helps to protect authors of creative works, and it incentivizes them by giving them a series of ownership rights over what they create. And the law now says that if a web designer develops your website or creates your logo, and there's no contract that says who owns what, you just paid them with an invoice, the developer or designer actually owns your website and logo, or they own the copyright to it.
But what does that mean?
That means that, let's say...
Let's take an example I know of. Somebody who didn't get paid creates a Facebook presence and a Facebook page for a company. Who owns it?
Well, the person that created the account in that situation would be the owner of that profile. Now, whether it's legal to create a Facebook page for another company and say a bunch of bad things is
no.
One thing.
It was a good, you know, they wanted it done. They just couldn't afford to pay for it.
Right, and so that's where the issue generally comes up in copyright law: is someone hires someone to do something, and they can't afford it, or there's some sort of disagreement or dispute between the person who did the hiring and the person who did the developing. And the person who hired them said, look, you know, give us the website, give us the social media pages, and we'll figure out payment later. Well, the designer and the developer has absolutely no incentive to do so because they actually own the website. And so sometimes they'll hold the website hostage and say, this is mine. I own it. I'm not going to turn it over until you fully pay me, or maybe pay me even more than what the parties initially agreed to. And so it becomes so important if someone is designing your website or your logo or is doing social media on your behalf, that you have a written agreement or written understanding that the person paying for that service is the one that owns it. Or else you might find that the person doing your social media can walk away with all of those fans, followers, and even deactivate the page itself, which could be a major problem for companies who invested time, money, and effort in developing a strong social media following.
So you, again, it's about policies and getting it written down, getting it in writing. Who owns it?
Get it in writing is the tip for the day.
And we move along to Jeff in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Fascinating subject. Thank you very much. Ian, a couple questions. I was writing them down as we were going, just more and more as we were going through. The first is, you had mentioned earlier that an employee was saying certain things about a product that they needed to disclose who they worked for. Does the area within the social media page where you set it up and you say something about yourself, where you work, is that adequate disclosure, or does it actually have to be within the post itself? By the way, I work for XYZ company, and Acme XYZ product is awesome because it is the best product out there, and the coyote will never catch it.
Terrific question, Jeffrey. And the answer is, it depends upon where that social media post was made. Meaning, if the employee has their own personal Facebook page and they put a status update on their own profile saying how awesome their product is. And it's clearly shown from their Facebook profile that they work for the particular company. They don't need to include any other additional disclaimers within that post. However, if this same employee now posts about the product on another page,
Amazon, for example,
Amazon, there's no way that I would be able to know that the person who posted that is an actual employee of the company. And so when it goes somewhere else other than that employee's page, then a disclaimer would be required.
Understood. Okay. Another question is, you had mentioned that you could be, an individual could be held liable slander, I guess liable because it is in writing, for something that would be incorrect that would be put on their page. What if you retweet something or you share something that was written by another party and you post it then effectively on your page, maybe with a comment, I agree with this, or some sort of affirmation, a short affirmation about the share or the retweet, and it turns out to be incorrect, are you liable under that scenario?
It's a really interesting question, Jeffrey, and one that we actually talk about in my law school class, which is if somebody shares somebody else's defamatory content on their page, can they be held responsible for spreading the defamation of the original content? The answer is technically, under an application of traditional defamation laws, it's possible that that could happen, but we've yet to find a single case where someone was held liable for someone else's defamatory statement simply for a retweet. Now, if there was additional comment that was made, such as through perhaps a quote retweet, where you are retweeting but also commenting, and your new comment happened to be defamatory, that person may be found liable. And I'll tell you what, I'm sure that in 2016, we're going to see many more of these online social media defamation cases coming up in exactly the circumstances that you're talking about. So stay tuned.
Thanks for calling, Jeff. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, Ethan. So before we go, and we're sorry to the callers and emailers we couldn't get to, I just want to talk about this organization, letsplantaseed.com. You are still a part of that? That's still where people discover their passions?
Exactly. So my dream has been to make the most out of life and to help leave the world better than how I found it. It's one of the reasons why I was working with a wonderful law firm practicing litigation for so many years, but realized that wasn't my true passion. My passion was educating and training and helping other people. And so in order for me to do that, I created the social media law firm and also Let's Plant a Seed. Let's Plant a Seed is a foundation that is designed to both help people discover their passions in life and encourage them to pursue what they believe in, what they're passionate and inspired about, but also to do what they love, to give back to the world in a lasting way through community service. And we plan monthly community service initiatives right here in South Florida to help those in need.
So we can find out more about Let's Plant a Seed where?
On letsplantaseed.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, Instagram.
Okay, and your new law firm, congratulations with that.
Thank you. This is the world's first social media law firm. You can find it at thesocialmedialawfirm.com, and it provides solutions to legal issues for businesses, startups, financial institutions, and human resources.
My, I think you got that down. Okay, well, it's been a pleasure, as always, to have you. And it's Ethan Wall, E-T-H-A-N, Wall. And he's an author, attorney, social media legal expert, consultant, and adjunct professor of social media and the law at Nova Southeastern University, and the founder of the Social Media Law Firm. And that other one is socialmedialawandorder.com, right? Okay. A lot of websites there. You'd never know you were interested in this stuff.
Easy to find me on social media and online.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ethan Wall.
And thanks for joining this hour. Our topical currents producers are Richard Ives and associate producer Polly Landis. Technical direction today from online producer Paul Leary. And don't forget about our free audio archives and downloads at the website, wlrn.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. No legal difficulties there. Tomorrow's program is Balm for Canine Lovers. It's the story of Greg Maley, famous as America's top dog rescuer. He saves them by the tractor trailer full. Some are wandering strays, others face the euthanasia needle. He's logged 1,000,000 miles to save 30,000 dogs. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.